The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, thank you. And I invite you to read a little bit more about Dean Grossman. He is in our program. I would love to tell you more about him, but we would be here for the entire weekend. He is amazingly accomplished and recognized in human rights circles. And again, he's amazingly supportive of his students and law students throughout the country. So now we're going to start with our first panel, and I'd like to introduce Professor Mary Clark. She's a professor here at the law school. I did not have the fortune to have her last year. I know she teaches first-year property and have heard amazing things about her, and she will be moderating this panel and introducing our speakers. So if we could please get a round of applause for Professor Mary Clark.
I'm pleased to be here this morning and very pleased to have you all with us this morning. I am not going to spend any time in introductory remarks so that we have all of our time for the speakers and for your questions and their responses. But welcome again to the conference and to the first panel of the day. We'll be hearing first in our panel from Mr. Robert Kennison of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Mr. Kennison serves as HUD's Associate General Counsel for Assisted Housing and Community Development. His interest in Latin America stems from his service as a Peace Corps volunteer in Colombia, where he worked on urban community development projects. Since joining HUD, Mr. Kennison spent a sabbatical year at the Yale Divinity School to consider issues of equity in allocating assistance to the poor, ethical responsibility of government officials, and faith-based action as a vehicle for community empowerment. He's a longtime member of the Inter-American Bar Association and was detailed in 2002 to the Inter-American Development Bank in Colombia, where he assisted the Colombian government in formulating new rental housing policy reforms. And we are delighted to have him with us today. He will be our first speaker, but I'm going to introduce all the speakers in order. Next, we'll be hearing from Professor Fabio Arcila of the Touro Law Center. Following graduation from Bolt Hall Law School, where Professor Arcila was an associate editor of La Raza Law Journal and a member of the California Law Review, he worked for 3 years as a staff attorney for Southeastern Michigan Legal Services. He then clerked for the Honorable Julian Cook, Jr. in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan, and for the Honorable Julio Fuentes in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Thereafter, he was a commercial litigation associate at Fried Frank in New York before joining the faculty of the Touro Law Center. And he is seated to my furthest right. Welcome and thank you for joining us this morning. We will next be hearing from two speakers who, one speaker who is present. Thank you, David. You popped in. We're very pleased to have with us this morning one of our own, Professor David Hunter, seated in the middle. Professor David Hunter is known to many of you as an expert in environmental law, in international environmental law, and we are just delighted to have him with us this morning. His work covers a broad range of global environmental and development issues, including multinational corporate responsibility and the role of international financial institutions. He previously served as executive director of the Center for International Environmental Law, and he is the author of numerous articles, as well as the co-author of International Environmental Law and Policy, the leading casebook on that issue. Following Professor Hunter will be Raul Hernandez-Cos with the Financial Market Integrity Office of the World Bank. He has not yet joined us, but we expect him shortly. He has worked extensively on issues of trans-border financial flows, focusing particularly on the effect of remittances. Mr. Hernandez-Cos, welcome. Thank you. I was just introducing you. Please make yourself at home. Thank you. Prior to joining the World Bank, Mr. Hernandez-Cos taught in the fields of law and international affairs in Mexico and is the author of the study, The U.S.-Mexico Remittance Corridor, Lessons on Shifting from Informal to Formal Transfer Systems. Mr. Hernandez-Cos currently works in the World Bank's office concerned with countering money laundering and terrorist financing. Our fifth and final speaker is seated between Mr. Hernandez-Cos and Professor Arcila, and that is Margarita Alario, and we are very pleased to have her with us this morning. She has come from the University of Wisconsin, where she's a faculty member in the Department of Sociology of Science, Technology, and Environmental Studies. She has an emphasis in international relations and peace studies, and we are very pleased to have such a distinguished panel. My understanding with the speakers is that they will each present remarks in the order of 15 minutes so that we have a period for questions and responses again at the end. We will start with Mr. Kennison, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Buenos dias. Mm-hmm. Es un honor y gran placer a asistir aquí en la conferencia. Y como he mostrado en menos de un minuto, mi castellano es muy débil. Por eso voy a conversar en inglés. It is a treat to be here. When David invited me, he indicated it was pretty much a free form exercise that each of the panelists would be engaging in, subject only to adherence to the theme of legal and economic empowerment. I did prepare an outline. I don't think that's reached you yet, though. I think it'll be issued after the conference. And so just by way of introduction, I'm going to discuss five things. One, what I call raíces, my own personal roots. Two, community empowerment. Three, individual empowerment. Fourth, the convergence and tensions that can obtain between those two phenomena. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about law students and an agency like HUD. First, my personal roots, as the introduction indicated, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Colombia 40 years ago.
I didn't
probably
mention
before
that
anybody here was born, but it was a life-changing endeavor for me. And I was in an urban community development program. That pretty much meant living in the barrio and working with the residents for betterment as they saw it and providing whatever assistance we could. We weren't very helpful. What struck me was how institutionalized and how dedicated Acción Comunal, community action, was in the barrio. There was a very formalized legal evaluation of the entity that was there to represent the barrio. They got us, I think it was called the Personería Jurídica, and it meant if you had this particular certification, you were authorized to represent the barrio in meetings with departmental or local officials. And there would be meetings of the Junta de Acción Comunal regularly, and I was always struck by, at least compared with American poverty movements at the time, how practiced and confident the residents of the barrio were. And this extended to the meetings that were held. In this country, we have polls every once in a while, and the poll indicates that people fear public speaking more than they fear death. Jerry Seinfeld, I think it's Seinfeld, who said something like, people would rather be the dead person than giving the eulogy for the dead person. But in the barrio, there was never any hesitation about any person speaking for his or her position. They weren't educated formally, but there was a real education of experience and a welcoming of the ability to articulate whatever the felt need was. So in short, that was a big deal for me and influenced my life. Another phenomenon of living in Colombia, or Latin America generally, is the importance of home ownership as an economic and cultural objective. And I'll talk a little bit about that when we get to HUD. But as I've said, that was 40 years ago. This is now. I have spent all of that time since as an attorney at HUD, and so my remarks will be through a fairly narrow prism. They are directed to the concept of empowerment, but in line with the invitation, we can handle this as we will. First, I'd like to talk about community empowerment. And what I'm talking about there is the opportunity that cities and counties and states have under federal assistance programs to promote empowerment for their own economic interest and for that of the citizens of the locality. And there is a trend over the last 20 years, and that is a trend to formula grants, or what they call block grants. And what happens here is the grant goes to the city rather than to a special purpose body. It's typically a consolidation of former categorical programs that were extremely tailored to special activities. There's much more flexibility now for the locality. There's less federal strings attached to it. Such federal control as there is in an audit mode after the fact. And finally, there's kind of a guarantee, what when we were first passing these laws, we called automaticity, which is a fancy word. What it means is that monies will be allocated pursuant to a formula which everyone agrees is based on reasonably objective criteria, like the need for housing or the poverty index or just raw population. And so we have several programs here that are aimed at that new approach for community empowerment. The biggest one, I think, is the Community Development Block Grant Program. Some of you may know of that, some may not. It's about a $4 billion program that goes to cities and very large counties and states every year. But we also have formula grants and block grants for public housing, for cities housing into the home program, for Native American programs. The Native American programs, there is a workshop on Native American programs. I don't know if any of you are attending. I think it's tomorrow. But for all of the legal questions that are posed to us in this area, we apply what is sometimes called the rule of sympathetic construction. And that is the theory that because the Indian tribe is a tribe, a nation, it's not like dealing, oh, I got my first yawn already. Because the tribe is a nation, we're not dealing with just a city or a county, statutes are to be construed more favorably in their behalf, and we typically do that. But again, this is a kind of a macro allocation statute in which there's broad flexibility in any case. But all of these programs I'm talking about have a low-income thrust. They're either limited exclusively to persons of low income, or they have to be targeted principally for persons of low income. And my outline is not in your hands. Is that correct? I'm right about that? I met with some Colombian officials. We have a little office of international affairs at HUD. And sometimes they ask me to speak with dignitaries from foreign countries. I met with two senators from Colombia, and I won't read you my translation of Wallace Stevens' poem. I don't know if you know who Wallace Stevens is. If he were alive, he'd be older than I. But he was a lawyer poet, and his whole career he made money as a lawyer at Hartford for the insurance companies. But he was a wonderful poet, one of the nation's greatest 20th century poets. And I won't read the translation that I gave to these two Colombian senators who were very moved by it, or at least were wonderful actors. But I'll read the five lines in English. This is from a poem called The Fading of the Sun. Who can think of the sun costuming clouds when all people are shaken, or of night and dazzled proud when people awaken and cry for help? I like that because I think that's kind of the watchword for poverty programs. And it's in my mind and the minds of a lot of the people I work with almost all the time. There's another phase of community empowerment in HUD programs that I'll mention just briefly because it uses the word empowerment. This is the Empowerment Zone program. This was the thought of a very conservative guy, Jack Kemp, who was a quarterback for the Buffalo Bills before you were born, who was HUD secretary, and who ran for vice president unsuccessfully, sometimes calls himself a bleeding heart conservative. This kind of community empowerment involves the designation of an area pursuant to certain objective criteria, and if you set up shop in that area, you're entitled to tax benefits. And I'm not sure how successful it has been yet. All the results aren't in, but it has obtained a lot of public support and a lot of people reinvesting in those areas. Okay, I want to talk about individual empowerment, and in the outline I have a quotation, and I will read it. Power can be taken but not given. The process of the taking is empowerment in itself. What do you think of that? I like it, Power can be taken but not given. The process of the taking is empowerment in itself. Those are the words not of the bleeding heart conservative, but one of the foremost feminists of our time, Gloria Steinem. And I think there's much to it, but I think sometimes people need a little help in moving toward empowerment. And that is part of the mission of HUD, whether it's at the community level I've mentioned or at the individual level. And home ownership is one of the desiderata economically, even culturally in this country. We now have over 73 million owner-occupied units. We have a national home ownership rate of 68%. The Hispanic home ownership rate is only 41%. The gulf between the two is narrowing, but very slightly. But HUD and its initiatives, particularly the FHA program, which has guaranteed mortgages for 18 million homes over the years. 18 million is a lot of homes. We are aiming towards incentivizing as much Hispanic and black home ownership as we can. The whole phenomenon of black empowerment is interesting. I think a lot of it comes from church activity. That was certainly true in the 50s and 60s, the marches. Again, getting a little help, the Supreme Court was a little help in Brown v. Board of Education and in Shelley v. Kramer. I don't know if you read Shelley and Kramer. Do you read
yes.
in your course, Professor?
Yes, you do. Second
Charlie
semester.
Carr was my property professor, yes. Property one, and Shelley and Kramer was on the agenda then, too. This is a case which doesn't say it's illegal to have restrictive racial covenants, which sounds sickening, but what it does say, and this is the zinger, when you use courts to enforce those restrictive racial covenants, then you've got state action, and that's impermissible under the 14th Amendment. That was a little help. Little help from the Congress, the Voting Rights Act, 1965, the Fair Housing Act of 1968. All of these things move toward one's own advancement of empowerment. And the thing I want to talk most about, and I think I have about 6 minutes, is the convergence and what I call tensions between the community and the individual. And I call to your attention, suggest for your reading, two decisions, you probably read one of them, two Supreme Court decisions of recent date. The first one is HUD v. Rucker. We were a defendant. This involved the eviction of a person from public housing. The person's grandson had committed some either illegal drug act or other illegal criminal action, and under the statute, it says the lease can provide such actions shall be cause for eviction. You don't have to evict, but they shall be cause for eviction. Do you teach this one in the course?
Not that particular case,
yeah, okay.
But a similar.
It was 2002, the Supreme Court, after we'd been losing maybe more than we were winning below, ruled 8-0 that the statute and the lease mean what they say. The public housing agency in public housing is a landlord and entitled to this right. You don't have to evict a tenant, but what had been propounded for several years was something called the innocent tenant defense. And that means if the grandmother has executed the lease, she doesn't have control over these guys. But in the District of Columbia alone, there are 34,000 people waiting on the list to get into public housing. And I'm assuming that each one of them will follow the rules. If this leaseholder has a family that doesn't follow the rules, and the PHA has given them opportunity and it's just not working, the right to eviction is there, and the Supreme Court so ruled. That is tension. Just for your information, there is a recent development on with respect to this case, and that's the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, which is trying to address a lot of issues, and one of them is protecting domestic violence victims who happen to be in public housing. We are concerned that if you carve out a little niche for domestic violence victims, then are you doing it for the grandmother again or for other people? In any event, the Supreme Court's position in Rucker now stands. The second case I want to mention is Kelo versus City of New London. Mm-hmm. Reading that one?
It's coming up.
Fascinating course to be doing that. I'll say only this. This is probably something I know about. I don't know about most of the Supreme Court cases in detail. This is probably the most misreported case in the local national press in the last 15 or 20 years. It involves the right of a city government to take property by eminent domain for a private reuse. Is that a public use, a private reuse? The Supreme Court 51 years ago in Berman and Parker said, yes, it is if that's slum and blighted property. The new leap now is the property doesn't have to be blighted, but it has to be for a bona fide, realizable economic development project. 5-4 decision, very close, raised a lot of attention. Finally, I just want to say that at HUD, we recruit heavily for Hispanic students. We should, for the federal government, but we do. We go to law schools where we think there may be a high representation of Hispanic students. Once we hire people, we make available attendance at conferences like this one or the Hispanic Bar Association, the RASA meetings, LULAC meetings. It's not a bad place to work because you have the commitment to public service, and the thrust of empowerment is ever present. I think I'm right on time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you to Mr. Kennison. I'm pleased to say my first summer job was at HUD. It was in New York, and I was working on the Section 8 housing program. So very pleased to have you with us today. Our next speaker will be Professor Fabio Arcila of the Touro Law Center. So thank you for joining us.
Very kind. I have to say I'm very... I hope it's not too ungenerous a surprise, but happily surprised to see that Fried Frank is supporting this, having spent 3 years there. So that's nice. But I'm going to be talking to you today much more from my background as a former legal services attorney and as someone who's interested in poverty law and teaches poverty law today. As I thought about the topic we were going to be talking about today, I couldn't help but continually going back to the political context and times we live in. And so I'm going to be giving more of an overarching policy talk than a more doctrinal talk, because I kept coming back to the implications that the type of conservatism that's dominating our political system right now has for the connection and the link between legal and economic empowerment. And that's one that's really driven and heavily influenced by not just a free market ideology, but a very absolutist free market ideology. Some of the most influential actors in this movement have very strong feelings about free market and limiting the role of government, and that has very significant implications for anyone who's concerned about the link between legal and economic development. So to talk to you about that, I'm going to first review the current free market ideology, and then going to explore its consequences. Going to examine the strategy they've taken to try and achieve their agenda, and then comment on what I perceive to be the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the movement. So the current free market ideology is dominated by anti-government ideologues who really, apart from defense or border control, seem to literally believe, at least if we are to take them at their word, that government can only have a damaging and destructive societal force. And the intellectual leaders of this movement have one primary concern, and that's capital efficiency, wealth, right? The free movement of money without restrictions or influence by government or regulation. And they believe that freeing capital from government-imposed constraints so that it can move with the utmost efficiency is the ultimate and crucial goal. And that's exemplified, for instance, by Grover Norquist. I don't know if you've heard of him. If you haven't, you should. Right? He's a very influential and well-connected conservative activist and president of an anti-tax lobbying group, Americans for Tax Reform, here in D.C., right, who is famously reported to have said, quote, "I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub." Right, that's a very hostile view towards government. Right, but realize that's not just an outlier view. That view is at the very heart, for instance, of the law and economics movement, one of the most influential legal movements we've had in the last few decades. For many adherents of law and economics, promoting unrestrained capital movement should be the aim of the law and the only aim of the law, because that's the way of accomplishing the greatest good, right? They say what the law should do is accomplish the greatest good. How do we do that? Their answer is unrestrained capital movement. And here I'm going to borrow the words of a colleague of mine who I think has put this very well and accurately described that movement, that for at least some adherents of this movement, those who are, have a very strong view about it, quote, justice is and only is the maximization of aggregate wealth and the promotion of allocative efficiency, unquote, where, quote, rights exist and ought to exist only insofar as they contribute to the maximization of aggregate wealth and in which a person's value and moral worth exist in and only in the degree to which that person is willing and able to pay. Right. The beauty of that is that applies equally to the rich and the poor. But the consequences, though, is it has very different impacts upon the rich and the poor. These people are willing to accept what they believe are ostensibly short-term consequences on the poor, right? Because it's clear the poor are going to be ravaged in this type of system. It's a system where free market is allowed to flourish, and there's no safety net, right? Because safety net restricts capital movement. So there's no minimum wage, no health care, because the poor can't afford it, no retirement security, no disability protection, et cetera. And as dramatic as this view seems, that is very much the world in which not only we live, but we're moving towards. That's the very basic intellectual underpinning of our government's current fiscal policy, right? The government's current fiscal policy right now is informed and defined by tax cuts, and very particular types of tax cuts, the types in under our current president. The whole goal of those tax cuts is to free capital, right? To allow the market to control capital. But we can see the consequences that has for those who are concerned between any link between legal and economic empowerment. Much more money for the rich. We've had increase in income inequality throughout the Bush years, and particularly not just at the top 10th or top 5 percentile where income is among the six figures. We're talking about tremendous levels of income inequality because the richest Americans, you know, six, seven, eight digits of income, are increasingly controlling most of the wealth in this country. And that in and of itself might not be problematic if everyone had adequate means, but that's not the case. Throughout the Bush years, we're also seeing increases in the poverty rates. So I want to talk about the consequences now. And if there's anything that you remember from the talk today, it's going to be these two points. These are the ones I want people to think about and walk away from, and you know, feel free to agree with me or disagree with me. But is that this free market ideology that I'm talking about today is a theory of economic empowerment that either explicitly or implicitly rejects any link between legal and economic empowerment. Right, that's the first point. The second point is, why is that so? And that's so because legal empowerment, by definition, impinges upon the operation of the free market. Now, that's not to say that the free market ideology is hostile towards all laws. I mean, some laws that are meant to promote the free and efficient allocation of capital are favored, like antitrust laws, although I recognize that's a bit of a controversial example, and certainly tax reform laws that are consistent with this goal. But other laws that introduce inefficiencies into the free markets are viewed with hostility, like all income redistribution laws and laws with protective regulation goals, like anti-pollution laws, Endangered Species Act controls, labor laws, for instance. So with that as the baseline, now we've looked at current free market ideology and explored its consequences. What is its current strategy? Free market ideologues focus most of their power and rhetoric on either ending government programs or privatizing them. Those are the two big goals, either ending them or privatizing them. And one of the things to recognize is this strategy is the result of their opponents' prior legal successes. Right? And the classic example is the rise of procedural due process protections, which I'm sure a lot of you are going to study while you're here. Right? This rise of procedural due process as a constitutional protection resulted from very concerted legal strategies in the 1960s and 70s that sought to use the courts to strengthen that link between legal and economic empowerment. And it was a highly successful litigation movement, especially as regards these procedural due process protections, right, with Goldberg versus Kelly being the primary example. To free market ideologues, this rise of procedural due process was anathema. And because, though, the nature of it was constitutional, it left them with a quandary. How do we get rid of these? And the only way to get rid of them is to avoid them, right, leading towards the emphasis of ending governmental programs or privatizing them. And we've seen very dramatic examples of that. The 1996 welfare reform law that changed the whole nature of welfare is a classic example. Not only did it end the welfare entitlement substantively by imposing a five-year time limit, right, after that 5 years, with very few exceptions, you're not eligible for federal welfare anymore, no matter how desperate you are. But it also ended any entitlement to procedural due process protections explicitly in the text of the statute, right, showing how important this goal of theirs is to avoid these types of restrictions. And we've seen a much more recent example, right, in President Bush's efforts to privatize Social Security, right? That's the whole point of it, is to privatize it, to encourage the reduction in the size of government and the extent to which it influences people's lives. I want to emphasize a few more points about privatization, because it's very important. In many ways, privatization is preferable to adherents of this movement, because it not only it helps them avoid the types of constraints on the free market that they want to avoid, like procedural due process protections, but at least to them, it ostensibly harnesses the market's power to address problems. And that's exactly what they want. There are a couple of problems with that, at least I think there are a couple of problems. One is, there's no acknowledgement that there are actual or potential conflicts of interest that crop up as businesses, right, private business, that support of this free market ideology receives governmental money to provide services that the government formerly provided, right, and recognize that often happens after key campaign contributions. And we've seen examples of this in welfare reform, where there's been many aspects of privatization, flows of funds from the government to private businesses, and there have been, you know, scandals in different states around the country, such as in Wisconsin's W-2 welfare reform efforts. Another problem with this view that the market provides all of our solutions is that there's no acknowledgement that some sorts of problems might be better responded to through different types of mechanisms, right? The presumption of these free market ideologues that the market is the best response to any type of problem is one that's not necessarily true, and as a matter of fact, there's abundant evidence to the contrary. Some types of problems might be better suited to be responded to by government, but others might be better suited to response by other actors, like governmental actors, maybe nonprofits. So that gets me then to my concluding area about, is this free market ideology, is it legitimate or illegitimate? And I don't think it's any surprise, I think it's largely bankrupt. I think that view is. Free markets, I know I'm not a historian, I'm not an economist, I'm happy to entertain opposing views, but as far as I can tell, free markets by themselves have always operated in ways that have left social problems unaddressed, because free markets have one goal, that's profit maximization. And that goal of profit maximization is not broad enough to account for conflicting social imperatives, right? If it was, we would never have had rivers that literally caught on fire because of pollution. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have situations where workers' safety was not addressed adequately in manufacturing plants. And these free market ideologues, not only do they ignore that, but they fail to acknowledge that when you look at the size of government in the regulatory state, it's grown in leaps and bounds at a couple different points in our history, excuse me. But every time that's happened, it has always been to address some rising societal problem that the markets not only could not address, but it often caused. Right, a classic example there is that the modern regulatory state started with the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was formed in large part in response to a very pressing social problem at the time, which was exploding steamship boilers. It was a brand new mode of transportation. These things were exploding. A lot of people were dying. So in order to advance their agenda, these free market ideologues have to actively ignore history. Instead, what they do is they're constantly focusing on this bright and unblemished future that they promise us if we only adopt their agenda. And that focus on the future makes it very difficult to combat the rhetoric, because it's always hard to argue against what's going to happen in the future. It's always uncertain. But occasionally, the bankruptcy of this vision, I think, becomes starkly clear. And we've had a tragic and very clear example recently with Hurricane Katrina and the response to it. That scope of that disaster was just so big. It clearly required a governmental response. I don't really know of anyone who denies that. And if for no other reason, then the government had to step in at least to recreate the conditions in which private economic markets could work, right? That didn't even exist once the hurricane went through. And when we looked at those images and the tragedy that happened after Hurricane Katrina, right, to the most vulnerable among us, I think it clarified their morality, or at least if you're not willing to go that far, then acceptability of a view where a worldview where a person's value and moral worth exist only in the degree to which they're willing and able to pay. Nevertheless, recognize that this primacy of these free market ideologues are continuing unabated even today. And the experience of migrant workers in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina provide an example. That's happened already in the past. Undocumented migrant workers formed a significant part of the casino and hospitality industry in the New Orleans and Mississippi areas, and they were ineligible for any federal aid, even though there's every reason to believe that they were in as dire conditions as anyone any group of the population in those affected areas. And it's also affecting us both in the present and going future, and going into the future, because migrant workers are likely to continue to constitute a significant part of the rebuilding efforts. There's a lot of work that needs to be done down there. It's very labor intensive. There's a lot of sanitation, clearance work, reconstruction work. Reports already exist of increased illegal immigration coming into this country just to fill that labor need. The federal government has waived prevailing wage laws, which is only going to encourage employers to use migrant laborers because they can minimize their wages and therefore maximize their profits. And the federal government has purposely sent signals that this workforce is going to be welcome. There are reports that the Department of Homeland Security is already assuring employers that it's not going to aggressively enforce labor restrictions against undocumented workers. And the result is predictable, and we've actually already had reports that there are employers who have employed undocumented workers in these areas and are refusing to pay for the services that were performed. So the lesson this has is that there's this disjunction between the desire to take advantage of the migrant workforce and the labor it offers, contrasts with the lack of legal protections that we want to offer these people. And it shows that there's a real bankruptcy to the free market ideology and real reason to question the extent to which it's the best solution or an acceptable solution going forward. So I better stop there.
Thank you for that thought-provoking presentation. We will now turn to our very own David Hunter. Thank you for joining us, fresh from torts. I hope you won't commit any torts on that. All right.
I could speak about torts. There's lots to be said about empowerment with respect to torts as well, but instead I will speak about the environmental movement, environmental law, and issues around empowerment. And I think in some ways the two previous talks set me up in some interesting ways, because I think when we look at the relationship of environment and environmental law to issues of empowerment, we do need to look at questions that differ between individual empowerment and community empowerment, and I'll point that out as I go through. And I also couldn't help but at least commenting quickly on Katrina. Not only if we wonder about the linkages between environment and community issues, you don't have to look very far beyond that, whether it's both the impact of global warming and intensifying hurricanes, or more directly, the failure to have a coastal policy that allows for wetlands and others to protect communities from natural disasters. And then even more to the point, a system of laws that allow for the disproportionate burden of toxics and chemicals to be placed in communities of color and of poor communities, which when the time comes, as it did in Katrina, leaves whole reaches of communities under what is essentially a toxic waste dump at this point. And in fact, Greenpeace sent a crew down there. I happened to be speaking with the people who went 3 or 4 weeks ago, and they went to the area which is heavily a rural area west of New Orleans, which is a community of color, a very poor community, also a community that's sandwiched between two large chemical facilities, and a community that was already bearing more than its share of the environmental burden of our industrialization. And the report back was simply, it's not politically right to say it, but don't go home. You can't go home. The facility, you go there, the air just makes your lungs burn, the ground, the water is a sheen, and this area that was home to 9,000 people was home to 9,000 people. It's unclear that it ever will be again. So the links are perhaps more clear today than they've been in a long time. But I want to take a step back and talk about how environmental law is actually very much built on the idea of legal empowerment. It was, first off, we may forget it, back in the 70s, it was a product of empowerment. It was the product of a large social movement that took place in the 60s, the late 60s and early 70s, that led to a massive writing of environmental legislation, 8 large, substantial environmental bills in just a few years under a Republican administration beginning in the early 70s because of the essentially because of the voices that were being called for around the nation and the large demonstrations that were being taken place. Through the last 30 years, we've started to understand, especially working internationally, and I'm going to talk both nationally and internationally here. I'll end with some comments about the international. But we started to understand and sort of label this stuff kind of environmental democracy. And internationally, in particular, the idea of environmental democracy comes down to three basic rights: the right to access information, the right to participate in decisions that affect your lives, particularly environmental decisions, and the right to access to justice. Now, these three rights have been kind of brought forward in environmental instruments, including the Rio Declaration, which was the first place where they really were set forth as three pillars. But they were found and located in environmental law from the beginning. Our environmental laws, wisely, I think, were based in probably the most important provisions in those early first generation of laws in the 1970s. They're very, very technical. Environmental law is extremely technical, which I'll get to in a minute. But they included, very importantly, citizen suit provisions. The idea that any citizen, any individual, thus individual legal empowerment at least, could bring suit to enforce federal environmental laws where there were violations of environmental law. So the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, those rivers that were burning. If you don't like the way the federal government is enforcing it, and we shouldn't like the way they're enforcing it, then there are ways that you can actually come forward. And the laws were built to make it relatively easy to bring those cases, to act in the theory of sort of being individual attorney generals. And under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, the first federal act, the entire act was designed around the idea of a dialogue between the community and individuals who were affected and the project proponents who were proposing to do something that would impact negatively the environment. It didn't have to be that way. In many countries around the world, environmental assessments are a technical process, and only a technical process. You get a couple of engineers, you pay them a little bit of money, you put them in a room, you tell them to worry about the impacts, they come out with a report, you slap OK on it, and you go forward. In theory, at least, that's not the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to put out an assessment before a decision is made that informs the community of exactly what's going to happen to them, and it is going to happen to them, and then engage them in a dialogue about whether or not that's an appropriate or whether there's a way to mitigate. So in theory, at least, and certainly the way that it was designed, NEPA is meant to be an environmental democratizing statute of at least pushing the right to participate, if we go back to those three pillars, and the right to have information. Unfortunately, and this will, I'll come back to this in a minute as well, it doesn't give you any right to decide. It only gives you the right to be consulted. NEPA is a very powerful and interesting law, and it's worth recognizing its power because for the first time in 30 years, it's about to come under attack because of the same ideology that was just spoken about. It is, in fact, a legal empowering law that does interfere with the flow of capital when people want to build a project. And it does so because it actually does the revolutionary idea of feeling like it needs to inform and talk to the people who are going to be living with the decisions that are behind it. And that often leads to slowing down projects in ways that are unacceptable to those who want to promote projects. And so within the next year, you're going to see the first assault on what is essentially the base benchmark of our environmental laws. Now, NEPA has its problems. And there are problems that are inherent to our environmental laws as an empowerment. And that is that the documents that come out are pretty hard to understand. They're very, very technical. There were early rules, though, that said that you had to be able to read them. They had to be written up to like a sixth or seventh grade education. They do have to be, they are not required to be translated. There were efforts to try to force their requirement to have them be translated to the language where the majority of the community. And this has led to some very unjust situations. There are a few state laws who have gone so far as to require the translation of impact assessments into the languages of the majority language of the communities, but they're rare, few and far between. Even the well-publicized community actions of the Kettleman actions in California, where the community was 40% monolingual in Spanish, even there, ultimately, the California state courts interpreting state law said, you know, it would be just and right to translate these into Spanish, but we're not sure we're going to require it. So there are certainly real shortcomings in the environmental laws as they were developing. And in particular, probably the biggest shortcoming from an empowerment point of view is that they are so technical and they are so legalistic. And one of the things as lawyers we have to recognize is that if we go to the courts sometimes and very tech and push our energy of a community into the courts, sometimes we're actually as much disempowering as we are empowering, the idea of community development. And I think environmental law is particularly risky at that because it becomes so quickly such a technical discussion about the technical aspects of violations of some federal law, and less so just what's right. I have a cousin who works for the Environmental Health Coalition, a community empowerment group in San Diego. And I always say about her, she doesn't let the facts get in the way of what's wrong or right. She doesn't talk about facts. She talks about what's right and what's fair and what's just. And there's a lot in the environmental community where we get wrapped up into the technical aspects of the details of federal environmental policy. But some of that changed a little bit in the story nationally, because the first movement that started the movement in the 70s was really a national movement of activists. It was also pretty much an upper-class white movement. It was mixed both with the idea of protecting nature and also of dealing with some pretty general environmental problems that everybody, no matter what your economic class, could see, which was that your lungs hurt, if you had to change your white-collar shirts at lunch in Pittsburgh, because they were so dark, you know, because the pollution was so bad in the 60s. It was affecting everybody. That started to change in the 80s when communities started to speak out and when the issues of hazardous waste siting and hazardous waste and toxic sites started to emerge. Love Canal, Tyne Beach, Warrenton, North Carolina, 1982, the first national environmental movement that was brought by a community of color, a PCB plant being located in the South, 1982, about midterm in our history of environmental law. That motion, that community empowerment, also raised and launched the environmental justice movement, a very substantial and significant part of the environmental movement that brought to the fore the inherent discrimination of the environmental laws against poor communities and, in particular, communities of color. Out of that movement, several things came. Out of the early discussions around hazardous waste, first we got laws that look a little bit more like community empowerment, in particular the toxic release inventory law that requires information about what chemicals are in and around a plant must be provided to the local community. Also, the actual legal ideas as well as the mobilizing ideas around the environmental justice movement. The facts were quite stark to what was then and still is a largely white and middle class environmental movement, that the most defining characteristic in the United States, if you wanted to explain where a hazardous waste site was going to be located, was race. It wasn't technology. It wasn't even poverty. 8 million Hispanic people lived in communities that had more than one unregulated hazardous waste site. And the proportions were much larger for minorities, obviously, than they were for even poor, and certainly for empowered whites. Because of the technical nature of environmental issues, the ability to get into court, the ability to use those laws requires resources, it requires a long fight, and it requires the ability to mobilize both legal resources and community resources, which just naturally came to the wealthier communities. And moreover, I think the environmental movement also had to look at the mirror and still has to look in the mirror about what it prioritizes, nature conservation over public health, for example, and over these issues of working with communities that bear a disproportionate amount of the burden. I want to jump for a minute, though, to what this has meant for the international for my last few minutes, because the jump is interesting there for several different ways. The same pillars can be looked at: access to information, right to participate, access to justice. But in the international field, it's been more difficult. A couple things in the last couple minutes I want to mention, though. Within many, many countries, and within many countries in South and Central America, these rights of access to information and these rights to go to court are being found in environmental cases. So now in Chile, Peru, Argentina, Colombia was one of the first to start it. Mexico, Costa Rica, last week for the first time in Jamaica, the first ever public interest environmental case was brought. In all of these countries, public interest environmental cases have been brought by communities or by citizens who have been pushing the limits of their own national laws and demanding their rights to participate. So that's quite exciting and quite interesting. At the international level, when we talk about empowerment, though, of course, individuals and citizens don't always have many rights. Those rights belong to states and our elected officials only, or so they'd like you to believe. But at least with respect to environment and with respect to human rights, the legacy that individuals and communities mattered have been brought to the international level. And you see that in many different ways. Access to information policies at the World Bank, at the Inter-American Development Bank, those policies are there because of communities asking for information that they weren't otherwise being given. More and more of that information about projects that they're going to finance are being translated into the culturally appropriate means. Sometimes that means acting things out because the community actually isn't literate at all. It may mean finding very obscure and very small languages that are spoken by a very small minority and trying to get it into that language. So there are efforts like that that are quite interesting going on, and they're all coming really from the heels of activism and social movement reform going back to pushing the law. The right to participate is interesting internationally because in particular communities, particularly indigenous communities, they don't really want the right to participate. They want the right to say no. They want the right to say, this project coming down the pike, we don't actually want it in our particular community, and we're not sure that we're being well represented nationally with our governance structure. So give us some rights that allow us to fight this legally. Those rights are few and hard to come by, but under the ideas of prior informed consent and prior informed consultation, there's a great international dialogue going on about it right now that you should join. I was involved in one in Yanacocha in Peru, a large mining company, Yanacocha, and they operate a mine way up on top of a hill. And the mining company for many years just assumed they weren't affecting the community. And then about 2 years ago, they started this elaborate process of negotiations with the community that was being facilitated by a part of the World Bank called the International Finance Corporation, an ombudswoman there. And I asked the company, why is it that you finally agreed to negotiate with the community? And I thought, I kind of knew the answer, but I wanted to hear them say. And it said, well, it's quite simple. The community got out and burned tires in the road and blocked off our mine, a mine that produces $2 million in revenue a day when it's operating fully. And you know what? We decided to come off our mountain and talk. Mm-hmm. And in that process, empowering the community perhaps to some legal and quasi-legal things. And I mention that because the two go so hand in hand. The community empowerment, without it, that opens the political space, both nationally and internationally, for the law hopefully to come in and get some good solutions and help cement those solutions. And we must be careful as lawyers that we don't squeeze out that activism and that empowerment that actually helps us move. There are also a few exciting things happening internationally about access to justice, which I won't talk about right now. And the last thing I'll say in conclusion is that we have to be vigilant, because every time we win one of these things, take the Alien Tort Claims Act, which I didn't talk about, but it's opened up a little bit of access to justice for human rights and environmental concerns internationally here in the U.S. 2 days ago, a bill was passed based on the idea of an interference basically with capital flows to try to restrict the use of the Alien Tort Claims Act by communities in this country. The NEPA is another example. So we have to continue to be watchful, and we have to continue to be vigilant, and we have to continue to push for this empowerment in the environmental area. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And what better segue to our next speaker, Mr. Raul Hernandez-Cos of the World Bank. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mrs. Clark, and distinguished guests. Good morning, and thank you for this kind invitation to participate at the National Latino Student Association Conference. My topic for this session of the conference will be lessons from World Bank's work on migrants' work remittances and anti-money laundering and combating of financing of terrorism. I will start with a few remarks about migrant work remittances, then move on to look at the impact of money laundering from a development perspective. We will review some of the factors associated to money laundering and remittances. And finally, I will share with you some lessons of our work on both areas, remittances and money laundering. Now, just a caveat before we start this morning, the thoughts that I share with you are from my own perspective as bank staff working in the remittances area and anti-money laundering. And my remarks are my own and do not necessarily represent the official position of the World Bank. Let me begin with a few brief notes on worker remittances. First of all, remittances flows are an important source of funds for many developing countries. Officially, recorded remittances flows to developing countries are estimated to have reached $160 billion US in 2004, registering an increase of 49% since 2001. Most of this increase occurred in low-income countries, where remittances rose by 82% during the period from 2001 to 2004. Most of the $41 billion increase in remittances to developing countries from 2001 to 2004 has been concentrated in South Asia, with $17 billion of U.S. dollars, Latin America and the Caribbean with $13 billion, and to a lesser extent, East Asia and the Pacific with $7 billion. This audience is surely familiar probably from their own personal experience with the importance of remittances in the context of migration, mainly from Latin American countries to the U.S. Remittances flows also tend to be more stable than other capital flows, including official aid. Evidence also suggests that remittances increase at difficult times, during an economic downturn and after a natural disaster in the migrants' home countries, when other private capital flows tend to decrease. For many island countries in the Caribbean and the Pacific, remittances have joint aid and tourism as primary source of income. Remittances have human cost also. Migrants who have made great sacrifices, often including separation from family, and incur a risk to find work in other countries. There are costs to the home countries if the immigrant workers are highly skilled or if their departure creates labor shortages in sectors that can negatively affect other actors in the economy. Also, if remittances are large, a country could face an appreciation of the real exchange rate due to a disproportionate influx of capital, which render export less competitive. On the other hand, remittance recipients can also help pay for imports and service external debt. Switching to money laundering, there are very important consequences of money laundering that are worth reviewing because of the breadth of their impact. Money laundering includes three stages that I will mention briefly. First, the placement of illegal funds in both financial and non-financial systems. Secondly, layering or further conceal their origin or ownership. And finally, integration of the funds in the economy or financial system appearing to have been legally earned. Money laundering can result in economic distortion, economic instability, and a loss of control of economic policy. For emerging economies, the presence of large amounts of laundered money can be extremely disruptive by changing money demand, causing more volatile international flows, or affecting foreign exchange rate, which could lead to policy making decisions that could be inappropriate or even harmful to an economy. With such consequences for money laundering, we must address the question of what the solutions are and how emerging economies could protect their financial system from criminal abuse. Among policymakers, there is an initial consensus that in looking for solutions, we must bear in mind that any solution must address the various factors that help money laundering to flourish. These factors include the following. First, a weak banking system. This enabled factor can be addressed by better regulation, improvement government monitoring, and increasing transparency. Second, underdeveloped capital markets. While this is harder to remedy and address in smaller and developing markets, it is similar to the banking sector, and that the more developed and stronger than capital markets, the more checks and balances there are to fight money laundering. Third, a large underground economy. It is hard to detect money laundering when there is an already diffuse sector of informal businesses that is difficult to measure and regulate. Fourth, substandard government institutions. High-quality government entities are fundamental for long-term growth, and their absence only allows more avenues for money laundering to go undetected. Fifth, and finally, quality of corporate governance. Well-run companies with high standards of ethics and integrity are vital to our efforts to limit money laundering and their consequences. So, in looking for solutions in this large problem, we need to bear in mind these five factors. Some economists have stated that money laundering is only the outcome of illegal activities. In other words, money laundering is the symptom and crime is the cause. So solutions should concentrate on the causes. Now, remittances transfers merge with the previous discussion on money laundering when policymakers and prosecutors attempt to untangle the illegal use of money transfers from the innocent one of sending money transfer for relative living expenses, remittances. Tracing any of the money to an individual in a remote corner of the world is all but impossible. And just as law enforcement officials find clamp down on one sort of mechanisms, terrorists figure out a new scheme. Informal fault transfer systems operate on the fringes of the global financial system. In 2004, at least an estimated 35% of the $160 billion in global transfer to developing countries flowed through these informal channels. In considering solutions to the problem of money laundering and its feeder activities, no one should deceive that this type of criminal activity will ever be fully eradicated. Having said this, the right response can only be found at an international level and accomplished only through international cooperation. The IMF, the World Bank, the Organization of American States, and other multinational organizations also provide some guidance on legislative and other solutions. Banking institutions often bear the biggest burden of costs of the legislative response of this form of staff, software, and processes devoted to anti-money laundering risk management activities. In the U.S., it was estimated in 2002 that financial services companies, banks included, collectively spent $129 million complying with legal and regulatory requirements related to anti-money laundering efforts. This figure is probably over 100% more than how much was spent before 9/11. For mid-tier banks, the cost of anti-money laundering technology may range from $250,000 to $500,000. For the big banks, the bills are, of course, in the millions. Other countries have experienced similar cost increases as legislative response have considered the fairly new need to factor the terrorist financing. Overall, this is a cost that must be paid by the banks, customers, and by society, more broadly. Most of the money laundering legislation enacted in various countries is directed at the banking and financial sector. Many bankers feel that the burden of law enforcement, particularly watchful for suspicious activities, has been shifted to them, obligating them to act as policemen as well as bankers. It is important to remember that overall, policy aim articulated by the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970 to safeguard the U.S. financial system from abuses of financial crime, including money laundering and terrorism or other illicit financing. Now, striking the right balance between the cost and benefit of the regulatory regime is the challenge that we are all working to achieve. As banks have implemented tougher anti-money laundering programs, one unintended consequence that we have seen in the U.S. is that those customers deemed to be a higher risk are finding it much harder to secure banking services. For example, money service businesses such as checks, cashier, and money remitters have had their accounts closed because of the perceived risk of money laundering or the potential cost for extra monitoring and analysis. Last year, the Central Bank of Mexico reported $16 billion being remitted from the U.S. to Mexico. With this amount, imagine the damage that the remittance industry could experience with these accounts being closed. If remittance operators are unable to access the legitimate banking sector for services, they will turn to informal avenues that only increase the chances of handling dirty money. Unfortunately, banks have made little progress in addressing the immigrant community. They charge off them 10 times more than informal channels, money is exchanged at official rates. It can take weeks for money to reach its destination, and even Western Union is unable to reach certain parts of the globe. As a result, many immigrants will seek means to get money overseas, whatever are the risks. In addition, many Latin American immigrants in the United States have immigrated illegally, which affects their access to banking services. At least 2/5 of the immigrant population is estimated to be illegal. The matricula consular card issued by the Mexican consulate had gone some way towards dealing with this problem by providing access to formal financial institutions. The barriers to developing the formal remittance markets in several regions of the world are not about technological limitations. Instead, the principal barriers are regulatory and in particular concern the AML regulations in the interplay between these sets of regulation and the immigration regime. The World Bank has developed and tested a methodology to better understand and monitor the size or nature of bilateral remittances flows, the incentives that influence them, and the mechanisms through which they are transmitted. Such data can inform and guide policies to lower remittance transaction costs, enhance the development impact in the recipient countries, and minimize opportunities for abuse. Bilateral remittance corridor analysis had already been conducted in 7 remittance corridors, the U.S.-Mexico, the U.S.-Guatemala, Canada-Vietnam, U.K.-Nigeria, Italy-Morocco, Germany-Serbia, and the Netherlands with Suriname. In closing, we have to acknowledge that there is a cost of anti-money laundering legislation, but I hope also we can agree that there is our benefits from the standing point of addressing the macroeconomic consequences of dirty money. And the challenge, as I mentioned it, is how to find the balance between regulation and access to financial services. When I was invited, I was trying to find the right tune to address this issue and link it with empowerment. I don't think I can talk specifically on empowerment, but I thought it was more useful to show you or present a specific example on how the bank advises clients, member countries, on finding the right balance between the international standards that are in place, such as money laundering and combating of financial terrorism, development issues such as migrants and workers' remittances, and finding the difficult balance on advising what are the right policies that countries could put in place. I will be very happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I look forward to our time for questions and responses and to engage you, the audience, and the panel. Our last speaker of the morning will be Professor Margarita Alario of the University of Wisconsin. And following her presentation, we will have time for questions. Our morning panel will run until 11:30, and then I know you have your next set of workshops. Professor Alario, thank you.
Thank you. Bear with us for just a second. So, can everyone see okay?
That's good.
Is that okay? Yeah? Well, thanks for your invitation, and in particular to David, who is responsible for dragging me to lecture. I get very nervous, so I don't know why I accepted the invitation. The other thing is that I have to confess I am not a lawyer, so bear with me. My perspective. My perspective is from the environmental sociological point of view, so I am going to be addressing. The background is, of course, the whole issue of relationship between environment, communities, empowerment, but I do it, again, from an environmental sociological point of view, very similar to one of the former speakers who is doing environmental law. Again, bear with me as a sociologist here. My work has to do with natural resources, sustainability or sustainable development and conflict. And I ask you to, as I speak, to keep in mind what kind of structural opportunity nations that are at war represent for the issue of empowerment. And so, with that said, just to give you a bit of a background, since I'm coming from the social sciences, we have to go through all these things of introduction, the justification of your research, the methods, and etc. Just so, to give you a bit of background, the end of the Cold War. Since the end of the Cold War, really, in the social sciences, we have opened very many new and exciting areas, and environmental social happens to be one of those. And having said that, I have taken upon this research for primarily two objectives, right? One is to really explore whether there is a correlation, in other words, whether there is a relation between natural resources, sustainability, and conflict. And this is, so far my work has been very general, but I am trying to bring it to Latin America, where at times it seems that it's an intractable topic, and it so happens that it's not. We really can deal with it. The other objective of this research is really to establish, to lay the foundations for some kind of quantitative tools to explore issues that go anywhere from Chiapas to, again, what seems an intractable civil war in Colombia, to some international conflicts between Peru and Ecuador in those oil-rich regions, or if you wish, a much more comparative analysis between the kinds of development that happened and that has gone between Argentina and Chile. And so the research of the plan of my research is a very simple one. We focus on natural resources. We have regrouped these natural resources into energy, precious metals, and agriculture. And then we work statistical analysis and see what happened. Just to give you a bit of a background, there is some existing research on this topic, right? And that has to do with actually influential economies such as Jeffrey Sachs, who speak of the natural resources curse. Essentially, what they tell us is that those underdeveloped nations that are rich in natural resources have, by and large, underperformed compared to those that are not natural resource rich, developed ones. And I do have troubles with this perspective, but let's give, before I get into that, let me tell you that also a different perspective takes on the environmental issues in terms of national and international security. That's a very interesting one, and it also has some implications for the topic of today, which is the empowerment of communities. As I said, I'm not so persuaded by some of the existing research, and hence my idea of taking upon the task of it. And what I see that is perhaps more relevant, and also relevant from your perspective as either legal scholars or lawyers, is to talk about what I have termed a political institutional curse. And by that I mean a set of very fragile democratic institutions that essentially public institutions that neglect to do their job, public institutions that are not transparent, and hence they really are fertile soil for corruption. And in that sense, rather than speaking about a natural resources curse, my focus, sociological of course, is to focus on those institutions that fail citizens and fail in the distribution of natural resources and fail communities. And in that sense, I ask, think about what kind of structure of opportunity these neglected, democratically fragile institutions represent for empowerment of any community. Very, very poor soil, if you wish. Just so you know, I went through the whole issue of the methods. No need to bore you with. Oh, let's jump through that. I already spoke about that. The methods, let's just skip through this, just so you know, yeah, we did the whole social scientific exercise in it. But I want to speak a bit more about the results. And I have to tell you that I was very surprised about the results of this, of what we found. Just a sec. Now, pay attention, okay, there is a series of. Pay attention to the second bullet. Now, I was very surprised to find that 58% of the natural resources-rich nations have experienced some form of civil war. I was also surprised to find that 64% of natural resources-rich nations have experienced international war. And finally, I was also surprised to find that 42% of these nations have experienced both national and international wars. Again, if you think about the consequences to any form of community sustainable development, this is a very serious issue. And as I said, I was truly surprised to find that this is the status of the world, since this was a global survey. In terms of the discussion, I just want to point two issues that might be relevant for those of you in legal scholars or in the making. If you couple natural resources rich to democratically fragile institutions, we are looking at a very fertile ground for either civil or international wars. Of all those natural resources, of course, as you can guess, rightly so, energy sources are the most prone to be fertile soils for war. Now, in terms of the conclusions, I am trying to bring this framework to the Latin American context to understand what kind of possibilities, what are the grounds for, most of you, all of you spoke before me, in terms of the community empowerment. And I do I also want to bring this very general framework of correlation between natural resources, sustainability, and conflict to bear some light on the on conflicts such as the Chiapas in Mexico, such as the civil war in Colombia, but also I want to understand some international conflicts that have been going on between Peru and Ecuador, mm-hmm. when it comes to rich oil regions. I also want to use this very general framework to understand some different kinds of developments that have gone between Chile and Argentina, and Last but not least, I want to tell you that if everything else is forgotten from the talks, and rightly so, please remember that the idea is to understand or remember that there is a relevance to understand the environment in the context of communities. And only then, when we really have gone through the whole, what at first seems intractable, problems of large proportions, now remember that these understandings will also, and I'm speaking from an environmental sociological point of view, will also shed some lights in terms of what we have been trying to, talk here, community empowerment, a legal framework of that community empowerment, and so on and so forth. Before that, however, my argument, and I will entertain question, is that let's pay attention to the environmental health and the communities within those natural resources frameworks. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a fascinating intersection of the environmental and peace studies. So I'd love to hear more about that. But now is the time for you to ask questions. I know that the conference organizers have set up the microphones with the specific thought that then everyone will be able to hear your questions. So please not to be shy about approaching the microphone with questions related to any of the speakers. And thank you, our first questioner.
Hi, my name is Bernice Espinosa from UC Berkeley. My questions are both to Professor Hunter and then to Professor Acedia. Professor Hunter, it seemed when you first started your discussion about the environmental movement that you said it started with poverty, but my understanding is actually that the environmental movement, as you stated later, was a very middle-class white movement that later became the environmental justice movement that does have a more race-oriented idea. If you could please discuss a little bit about that. And then in the same vein, this goes a little bit to both yourself and then to Professor Acedia. This practice of coming to conferences is very much embedded in privilege. The ability to come and have the ivory tower discussion about these issues, and yet we talk about empowering those who are impoverished. If we use the dialogue that we have today, we're not going to be able to do that in a very practical manner. So in regards to Professor Acedia, how do I explain to my mom and dad about the free market ideology that even though they really want their tax cut on their house, how that's really going to hurt schools and other social programs? And also to my peers who are in the academia and who very much have internalized the free market ideology and who say, oh, well, tax cut will become free market flow, we'll be able to increase the economy, and it'll be able to actually help our government in the end. Then to Professor Hunter.
Oh, my.
Taking notes.
Yes.
The same idea. How do you approach someone as someone who has a legal education, mostly white male or white women liberals in Oakland, to go tell them about their rights in a place where there's not necessarily that affinity, that it can be a hostile situation, especially in terms of other race politics.
Good, thank you. David, if you'd like to start, and then Fabio, and then you could return.
Next question? Oh, no. I hope I either misspoke or misunderstood. What I said was that the environmental movement began with empowerment, not with poverty. It was a response to a social reform movement that was, in fact, a white middle class primarily movement. So I didn't mean to suggest in the 70s that it was a response to poverty, just the opposite. And its response to also, what I meant to suggest to the rest of it, was that the response embraced the idea of individual empowerment within citizen suits and things like that, but never really understood and still has problems understanding community empowerment and some of the issues around community. So the technical aspects as well as the genesis of the movement, being as it was, has limited its ability to reach out and continues to do so. And then the great both insight and effect of the environmental justice movement really wasn't so much a legal advance. In fact, it did bring some legal theories of using the civil rights laws and equal protection in environmental type cases, but those primarily, for the most part, failed because you have to show intent, discriminatory intent. But what the very important aspect of the environmental justice movement was to show, as I said, the impact, the discriminatory impact of environmental policies. And for the environmental community itself, it kind of put itself right into a mirror and said, look, you aren't reaching out, you're not addressing those issues. And there's several different aspects for it. One is certainly the racial and class issue, and the other is the which may be related, is the so much of the environmental movement's energy has been put into federal policy making, a policy wonkism in a way, as opposed to organizing and working out in the communities. And to answer your – and that continues to this day. We have way too much activity going on in Washington and way too little activity as a movement out organizing. And you can actually look at the dollars. If you look at the women's movement, they spend a lot more money on political organizing and Emily's List as a percentage than they do in national policy organizations like we have here in Washington, D.C. It's a recognized problem among some in the environmental movement. It hasn't yet, we haven't yet seen the change that we need to change. Now, how do you do the conversation? The first step is you do the conversation. The first step is you try to do the conversation. The second step is you reprioritize to a certain extent some of the issues. As I said, we don't look enough still at public health issues, at the question of, which are going to be the questions that are going to affect communities. So I think the linkage needs to be made much greater to issues of public health, and the incidence on the poor and communities of color of both citing and other decisions. I mean, the facts are quite clear in that respect. The response isn't there yet.
Could I add, just because I you were raising an important issue in terms of the ivory tower, but I did meet the sociologists, Robert Buller and Wright, who were very key. I mean, it was very powerful to see them walking with the community and give statements about what they find in the sociological findings of these communities in this proportion. And there was a moment where community and this academe, in both in Atlanta and in Louisiana, that's where they are located, walking hand by hand. And it did represent an empowerment to the community to have these people, and simultaneously it validated the kind of work that we do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we do have those validating mm-hmm. moments, thank goodness.
Yeah, how to talk to your parents, 101. There is a very pervasive paradox in this country, right? And it's one that a lot of migrant communities get wrapped up in, which is people come here for the American dream, and that American dream is such a strong ideal. But it's one that has always been problematic in this country, because there have always been people who work tremendously hard throughout the course of their lives without really advancing in any significant ways. And so one of the things that we need to do, and this kind of goes back to the point of my talk, was that as budding lawyers and people, you're going to enjoy a privileged status. And you've worked hard for it, and you should feel good about that. But with that comes responsibility, and there's a responsibility to be well-informed, to be thoughtful about what's going on, to see that sometimes there are movements that link different developments that would otherwise seem to be unconnected. And that was one of the themes I was trying to explain in my talk. And one of the implications of that is, as part of the discussion that you're suggesting maybe needs to happen, is that there needs to be more of a discussion in this country about what's a social obligation. Because the current rhetoric is one that's relatively unanswered, right? So the Democratic Party hasn't been effective in coming up with its own rhetoric, but it's one that's dominated by advancement of the free rider syndrome, right? And the free rider syndrome has become so pervasive that it makes everyone hostile towards taxes if they feel like someone else is getting benefits that they're not getting. And it's one that's not necessarily true. There are lots of government programs that are extremely well managed, like Social Security, retirement benefits, for instance. And so it's just a matter of having an ongoing, long time discussion that's respectful. You know, I don't know of anyone who thinks that they hold views that are wrong. Everyone thinks that they're right in their views. And I've never had a discussion with someone where at the end of it they say, you know, you're right, I'm changing my opinion 180 degrees. It's always a matter of a long time process.
And they are your parents.
Yeah, my parents are part of that myself. So, it's not. I've had discussions with people where they start ranting about this type of rhetoric, you know, about, oh, the government's wasteful, they're not, they're, my taxes are too high. And I had one experience in particular when they did that for about 5 minutes, and then the very next words out of my mouth is, and look at my poor mother, her Medicare benefits aren't high enough, you know, they're leaving her out to dry. And those are completely contradictory positions to take. To say that the government should be providing more benefits that are specific to me, but leaving other people out to dry is, you know, it's antithetical to the whole concept of government, because government has lots of different social needs that need to be met. And so there's just an ongoing discussion that has to take place about the extent to which there are pressing social needs the government has a legitimate role to play.
Thank you. Well, I'd love to entertain another one or two questions, so please.
Hi, my name is Viviana. I'm a 2L at University of Illinois College of Law. And first, I'd like to
thank you for coming.
Thank you. Yes. I'd like to thank all of you for sharing your perspective. It's an incredible privilege for me, and I think for all of us, to sit in your presence and listen to your experience. My questions are pretty basic, and they're for Professor or Mr. Hernandez-Cos. I'm Puerto Rican, and I think I'm pretty early in my legal education. So when I was listening to you, I felt like I missed a lot because your perspective seemed to assume a level of knowledge that I totally lack. So my basic questions are, one, what exactly is a remittance? And two, when we talk about money laundering, like, what is that, for example? I understand that both of these things are controversial and that governments engage in them and that they have this, like, positive and negative kind of influence. But as far as a starting point, I was wondering if you could fill that in for me and maybe for some of the other students. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question, and it's an opportunity to extend in my previous presentation. I will start by addressing the issue or answering the part of money laundering, and put a little bit of context why I'm talking about it and being as a bank staff. We started working on money laundering and combating on financing of terrorism after 9/11. So the bank, which is an international organization, became involved in an international new area as a result of what happened in the U.S. And that created a series of questions within our members, country members, why the bank should be involved in an area such as money laundering or anti-money laundering and combating financial terrorism. Money laundering is not a new area in the sense that it's always has been related to crimes that had been committed and how the proceeds from those crimes are laundered. That's money laundering. So you could, let's say, a corrupt official in a developing economy try to conceal, launder the money that is actually taken from the state. That is a crime, and there's a series or a list of crimes that are considered predicate offenses that become the reason for money laundering. So you have first a criminal activity, and then when the integration to the financial or non-financial sector is done, it becomes money laundering. The other part of our work is combating or financing of terrorism, which it has a different origin. You could have legitimate funds that are used to commit a terrorist act. So let's say in some developing countries also, you could have people that are receiving money from abroad, let's say from the US, that is used to sponsor a terrorist cell or a terrorist organization. Or what is worse, in some cases, is not to sponsor the terrorist act, but to support the family that is left behind a suicide bomber. So the nature of these two activities are quite different. But in general, there is a series of international standards to combat both activities. So both that have different nature. One is purely associated to criminal activities, which is money laundering. And the other one is associated to legal activities that could be used or could be linked to terrorist acts. The two create a new demand towards the bank to support developing economies on combating both money laundering and financial terrorism. The second part of your question, remittances. At the same time that we start working on money laundering and combating of financing of terrorism, remittances became a very hot topic in the development agenda. As I mentioned before, just last year, $160 billion was registered as remittances going from mostly from developed economies to developing economies. If you consider the amount, this amount for some countries is higher than the amount that they received by international aid or foreign direct investment. So the macroeconomic repercussions for a developing economy of having these flows are huge. In some countries, for example, Mexico received $16 billion last year of US dollars, and it represents 80% of the country's revenue that receives from oil. So if you imagine the scale of these flows, it's very dramatic. And it has also implications for the work we are doing, because when countries develop policies, they need to consider what are the different flows that they get into their economy and what are the policies that they can implement to maximize these flows. So what I wanted to do with my remarks that are within the policies that we have to deliver speeches and that kind, this type of presentations, so we need to follow some procedures, is to link both issues. Imagine a country that is committed to comply with international standards in money laundering, combating of anti-money laundering and financing of terrorism, and at the same time, it needs to protect the inflow of remittances that it's receiving. So you don't want to put in place regulations that hurt one, the senders in the country of origin of these remittances, and the recipients in the developing economy, because yourself is getting affected by the set of regulations that you could implement. But at the same time, there is the international community, which is promoting, to avoid the world pushing, a set of standards. So our work, and this is where I think my contribution to this discussion of empowerment is to help countries to find the balance so they can comply without hurting their own citizens abroad or in the recipient country of benefiting from these remittances that they are receiving. And I won't answer the question of what is remittance, because there's a huge discussion on the definition of remittances. I just will say that it's the money that a migrant worker is sending back home.
Thank you, Mr. Hernandez-Cos, and thank you to all the panelists. I'm mindful that you have a rich set of workshops that are upcoming, and so we'll let you travel to them, but I'm sure our panelists would also welcome individual questions, so thank you.